So welcome everyone to the Art of Advisory, a podcast slash webcast by my co-host Kirk Bowman and myself, Hector Garcia, where we talk about how to transition to advisory services and what does being a business advisor look like. And we're going to look at it. We're always going to talk about it from the perspective of my colleagues, accounting professionals, and Kirk Bowman's colleagues, IT software developers. So we're going to sort of combine both of our backgrounds and talk about what advisory looks like. Hey, Kirk, how's your week going?
Hey, I'm doing good. Can't complain. It's sunny.
What do you think about the first episode?
I thought it was good. I mean, it's a great place to start just to define what advisory looks like. But I'm excited about our conversation this week. We're actually going to talk about having an advisory conversation.
The first thing I wanted to talk about was what we talked about last week. Something that you said that I really, really liked, and it actually sent me to do some research, which you were talking about the smile curve. Do you want to just briefly talk about the smile curve real quick? Because that's, you know, there's one piece of the smile curve that we're going to focus in, which is the conversation. So can I just briefly summarize what the smile curve is?
Sure. So the smile curve basically is a graph where basically the graph itself is a U or a V. And the idea is that the two things that are most valuable to your customer are the two top ends of the U or the V. The things that are least valuable to your customer are at the bottom or the trough. What makes the smile curve really interesting is that it's the inverse of what we think. In other words, what we naturally think as developers or accountants or bookkeepers is most valuable is what's at the bottom. And typically what's at the bottom is where we spend most of our quote effort or time. But the things that are most valuable to the customer are actually the things at the two top ends that actually don't require a lot of quote time. They really require a lot more of experience and judgment, which is why we put it under the category of advisory. So if we take software, for example, figuring out what to build, not just taking the customer's suggestion of what you build, but actually defining the problem, even making sure you're asking the right question, kind of all of that preparatory work at the beginning would be at the start on one side. And then on the other end would be when the support that you actually provide after the system goes live. Software developers tend to think writing the code or what they do in the middle of the project is most valuable. It's actually the least valuable.
Right. So all service work engagements, anytime that you as an individual or your business or the team in your business is engaged to do service work, normally it's going to go through let's just simplify things, three stages. The initial stage where we understand what the client needs and we basically draw out the plan, give them a price, which is an extremely important piece of it, which we're not going to focus too much on today, but you know, give them a price, give them the scope, expectations, limitations, you know, who does what, that sort of thing. That happens at the beginning, and that would be the left side of the U. Then all the work that we do from there, which is like sort of the grunt work, mechanical work, data entry, data programming, dealing with issues day to day, that starts declining and getting towards sort of the bottom of that U or that V. Then once we start creeping up to the delivery of the work, such as, you know, showing them the final report, showing them the final piece of software, giving them that solution, putting them in that better position that they were from the start, that's the other high value part. So what's interesting about it is the easy, quote unquote, the easy part of the job, the one that takes the least amount of resources and groundwork, is going to be on that beginning of the U, which is the value conversation, understanding the project, and, you know, I'm planning it, and then the final delivery of it. But what's also interesting on the other side of the coin is that the vast majority of costs and resources happen under the bottom of that U. So there's an inverse effect from what we as a service professionals feel is the most costly or the most dominant piece of the work and the part that the client actually values. So with that, Kirk, let's talk about the beginning of that U so we can use that as a segue. Let's talk about that value conversation and what does that Q&A session look like with our clients?
Well, it may be more applicable to talk about what it's not, but I would just start by describing how I approach it. First of all, if it's the initial conversation with your customer, you're going to need to give them a little bit of time to talk. You need to give them the opportunity to kind of do a brain dump. In other words, they called you because something has prompted them to reach out. There's something that either an opportunity they're trying to take advantage of, or there is some pain or a problem they're trying to solve. And so you need to know what that is. But a lot of times they will self-diagnose. So they won't call you and tell you the problem. They'll call you and tell you what they think the treatment or solution should be for the problem. And although we're not going to provide that solution just because they say so, you need to give them a chance to talk about it simply because they need to be heard. So I'll give the customer, you know, if it's a 30-minute phone call, I might give them 5 to 10 minutes. If it's longer, I might give them a little bit more, probably no more than 15, but I will let them talk. Try not to interrupt too much. Although if I feel like they're going down a rabbit hole on something that, you know, really is just, you know, the color of something, for example, right? Are we going to use a blue button or a green button? We're not going there, but let them do a brain dump. But once they have, then I really want to step back and ask a question. And my favorite way to start it, this is, I just find this question tends to uncover a lot, is why do you feel like now is the time to solve this problem or to address this opportunity? Sometimes I'll follow it up by saying, or why didn't you do it 6 months ago? Or why wouldn't you wait another 6 months? In other words, I'm bringing the idea of timing into it, because timing a lot of times is a critical factor in why they need to do it. So that's where I start. What about you?
Yeah, that's actually a great place to start. You know, one of the, as you said, the initial phone call or the email or however is it that they contact you first, where they say, hey, I want to hire you, typically contain the actual solution. Like somebody will call me and say, Hector, I need to hire you to clean up my QuickBooks. I need to hire you to do my taxes. And those are the services that we provide. And for the most part, you know, if we actually, like you said, we hear them out, follow along, normally the client starts jumping straight into price. Well, how much will it be? How much will you charge me for this? And like you said, you know, a prescription without a diagnosis is malpractice. So you do have to figure out a way, and this is a huge challenge, figure out a way to turn the request for, hey, I need you to solve this problem for me, to, hey, let's have a conversation to figure out what the root cause of the problem is, so we can design a service around not only solving the immediate need, but also setting up a system in place so the issue doesn't happen over and over, and or the next time that we have to do the same thing, because in accounting, there's a lot of repetitive services, monthly bookkeeping, quarterly tax returns, that sort of thing. But next time we're in the position to do this again, that we're not running around and that sort of thing. Like you said, timing, right? We're talking about, we're in tax season. So a lot of people, I even had a person call me yesterday that they hadn't filed the 2016 tax returns, that they're in Florida, so they have an automatic extension to the 31st of January. So my question was, hey, how come you didn't do it before? And the client said, well, you know, whatever, I just procrastinated. And then I noticed that they had another accountant. And I said, you know, where was your accountant reminding you to do this? And they're like, you know, my relationship with my old accountant is, it wasn't so good. So all of a sudden, the client just gave me an open door to have a discussion around what went wrong in that relationship with that accountant, because they never called to say, hey, I have a problem with my accountant, I need you to help me. They called to say, help me file a tax return. But believe it or not, going down that path, saying, hey, I would really like to understand what went wrong. And usually this is the killer question to ask. I'll say, can I ask you permission to ask you some questions that allows me to understand your situation and serve you better? Typically, that's just a redundant question. Nobody ever says no to that. So when they say yes, they're giving you a permission. And the key question I say is, what went wrong with the relationship with your accountant, so I can note it and make sure that if we're going to work together, I don't make the same exact mistake. Now, granted, many a times the client-accountant relationship doesn't go bad necessarily because of the accountant's fault. Sometimes, and I'll tell you, and some of my clients may be watching this and say, sometimes it is your fault. You're the ones that don't bring us the information or show up on time or are not clear about what you want. But as a service professional, as a person that labels themselves as a business advisor, we should know better, and we should sort of almost plan to foresee those problems. So we have to establish a relationship in which the expectations are sort of set up front. So when I first start, I think, in my opinion, when we first start, the first thing we want to know, especially when it's a business switching from accountant to accountant, is to say, hey, what went wrong? Because my commitment is not to make the same mistake. and down that conversation, you are going to have you're going to have different avenues. I mean, they may say, you know, they didn't file in time. I send them the forms. They may tell you something like, you know, I emailed them the forms and the stuff got, you know, lost in the shuffle. Now, you know, you're going to write down to say something got wrong with email. So then we'll know that we're not going to communicate with this client via email. We know we will set up a portal. And what's interesting about it is a lot of times, especially when you get a potentially really good client like this, we think only of the resources that we have, you know, like, do we have a portal? Do we have this? Do we have that? And we only want to offer within our toolbox. However, when a client is coming in asking for value, they're saying, I went somewhere and I didn't get the value. I'm coming to you and I'm have an open mind to see what value you can offer. Then you want to start thinking outside the box, saying, hey, with this particular client, maybe it's worth it for me to get a document portal, because the expectation of the last accountant is, hey, I should be able to send something and not get lost in the shuffle. So a portal could help. So it's just an idea of how we go. And we also go through specific set of questions. Now, Kirk, you were mentioning what does the engagement not look like, right? That was one of the things that you started with. Now, what do you think, I'll just ask you, we didn't prepare for this, what do you think are the most common questions that our clients ask me the first time they see me, or they ask an accountant the first time they see? I'll have you guess. What do you think clients ask the most? Top five.
So I'll answer your question, but I want to address one point you brought up because I think it's real important. And it's an example of why we have this conversation. So your example was somebody comes to you in February trying to file, you know, taxes that are past due. So the idea there is, okay, you uncovered the fact that they had a previous accountant and something there did not go well. Another way you can address that would be something along the lines of, hey, what are some other ways you tried to solve this problem? Or you could ask, is this the first time you have attempted to solve this? What I find a lot of times is customers have tried to solve the problem more than once. They usually will not reach out to a professional the very first time. So again, the idea, how have you tried to solve it before? If there was another professional involved, asking questions, I don't really care, you know, whether they like the previous professional or not, they're still working with them. I mean, I need to know, but really what I know is just what is their perception of the relationship. Now, I don't take everything they say at face value. A lot of times I find at least 50% of the responsibility for a relationship not working is on the customer, but some customers will be very defensive about that. So like you said, if I sense something, I just make a note of it, unless occasionally I'll sense, like, for example, the email thing, I might just say, well, hey, what is your preferred way of communicating? If email doesn't work for you, right? I'll play it up. I'll try not to put them on the defensive, but I'll try to figure out, at least in their opinion, what they think works. So just some ideas there. So your question to me was, what does a customer who is seeking to work with an accountant ask you first? Wow. I have no clue. So don't keep me in suspense. What do they ask you?
So the first question that they ask, it's the most common one, is how do I pay less taxes, right? And I'm going to park that for a second because I have a very long answer for that, coupled with a very short one that's comical, but it's not. It's real. The other questions that we ask are things like, how do I reduce my costs, right? So that's really, they say, hey, you're an accountant, help me reduce my costs. And in some cases, if we're lucky enough, our clients will ask you something like, hey, how do I grow my business, right? So those are typically the three things that we get. The problem with trying to answer the three of them is they're almost at odds, all three of them. So let me explain. So if somebody says, how do I grow my business? They're asking about increasing the sales, right? So if you're going to increase the sales, you're going to increase the profit, and then you're going to pay more taxes, right? So that's actually the opposite of the first question, how do I pay less taxes? On how do I reduce the cost, it's a good question, because I don't think anyone should be wasteful with cost. But I will tell you, 9 times out of 10, the costs are not the issue. Typically, it's the process. It's how the tools are being utilized. Are they being fully utilized, or are they using the correct tools? Most of the time, most people, especially business owners, tend to be a bit more frugal with their business expenditures, like because it's something the business is going to use, so they don't really get to sort of enjoy it in their personal lives. Where in the personal lives, they see the personal enjoyment piece of the expenditure a little bit more. In other words, you know, like if you're going to go with your family to a vacation, you may stay in a room that's, you know, that's perfect for a family, that's comfortable. You may eat, you know, more expensive. But if you're going to take a 2-day trip to a conference in Texas to see half of a conference, like I did last year, I stayed at the cheapest hotel. I ate fast food, that sort of thing, just because we're a little bit more utilitarian and a little bit more practical when it comes to those things. But bottom line, I believe that a lot of times when a client asks me, how do I reduce my costs? It's the best thing to do is try to change that to, hey, let's take a look at your inventory of tools, especially the subscription, because right now this is one of the biggest issues that we have with small businesses is that, you know, they kind of have subscription fatigue and they subscribe to like 20 different services and apps, and half the times they're not using it or they forgot all about it. And, you know, between $100 here, $200 there, $50 here in a monthly service, it really does add up. So I think that going down the rabbit hole of trying to answer, how do I grow my business? How do I pay less taxes and how to reduce my costs on the first one? I don't think it's the best way to go about it. I think that we should take the approach of saying, hey, walk me through your typical business process. Tell me how your clients find you, right? How does a new client find you? And those are questions that accountants don't ask, but you have to start from the beginning. And then when they say, well, they usually call, and then we say, okay, who answers the phone call? Oh, Mary answers the phone call. Okay, how well is Mary trained on sales, or does she route that to a salesperson? Well, she just answers the phone, she routes it to a salespeople. Okay, how many salespeople you have? I have 10 salespeople. Okay, and what kind of sales training have you done for them? Oh, don't worry, my salespeople are great. Okay, and that's fine. And believe it or not, this is extremely valuable, because as you go down the line of questions that typically accountants don't ask, the client gets a little bit more, gets sort of perplexed in both a positive and a negative way. I mean, the client sort of turns saying, huh, I like these questions because it's about my business, but where is he going with this? I thought he was my accountant trying to help me do my taxes. So make sure that you gauge along the way as you ask those questions, what they're dismissive about, you know, like, oh, don't worry, my salespeople are great, or what they welcome. Because if they say something like, you know, we don't do much training for them, but they're all pretty good. I think they're pretty good. And that's it. They just gave you an indication that there may be a way for you to just, as an observant, you know, just give your opinion about how, you know, what's going on with your sales process. You understand what I'm saying, Kirk? I mean, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, there's several good nuggets that I want to pull out of what you just said. First of all, that idea of subscription fatigue, I have not heard that term, and I am stealing that. That is awesome. The other great idea that you had there was this idea of, what are the questions that accountants do not typically ask? I think that's a great category. And, you know, it's hard for you as an accountant to know what questions accountants don't ask, but boy, that is awesome. To kind of follow that theme, you know, you were talking about, you know, reducing costs or increasing sales or whatever. I would dig further. First of all, I know for a fact that reducing costs is not the best way to grow a business or to help, you know, improve a business or whatever. Okay. It's not. And maybe, you know, typically you're only going to get about a 10 to 15%, you know, benefit from reducing costs. And if you've been focused on reducing costs for a while, there's just only so much you can do, unless you're doing everything manually and there's a big, you know, opportunity for automation. But those companies are less and less out there. And the ones that are still doing it manually may not be the best ones, you know, the best customers, because they, you know, they're hanging so far behind. But again, I would just question the owner. Okay, so why do you need to increase sales? I want to know how increasing sales is going to impact that owner. I want to know, okay, it is finally going to get me out of the sales meeting. I hate going to it. It is going to allow me to take a vacation. My wife has been after me to go to Greece for 2 years. Man, I've got a kid who's 16. He has got to go to college and I have done no savings. What is the reason there? And it might be personal. It might be for the benefit of the business or the stockholders. It might be both, but I want to try to get that deep. So under the category of questions accountants do not ask, accountants don't go deep enough. They don't ask why, or they only ask why one time. You could possibly rephrase your idea there. Questions accountants do not ask more than once, because asking why once is not enough. Twice is not enough. You typically have to go about five times. You need to be able to ask it, you know, three, four, five different ways. You need to be comfortable. In fact, you need to get to a point where if the customer pushes back, you can explain, well, I'm not just going to take your self-diagnosis at face value. I want to understand. Besides, you're not an accountant. I am. Or you're not a software developer. I am. I do this all the time. So while you only talk to one accountant once a month, I am an accountant who talks to tons of customers, you know, every year. And so I know more about what an accountant or a software developer can do for you than you do. So under the area of questions accountants do not ask, now that I've kind of talked through it, I would say they don't ask why enough. What would you put in that category?
Yeah, and I'll answer that one, but I was thinking about, because you mentioned accountants and bookkeepers, you use the actual labels. And one of the reasons why we're doing this art of advisory is, and we're specifically using the word advisory, because in language, there's everything. In labels, there's everything. You know, a bookkeeper is a person that keeps books, right? An accountant is a person that counts. If you walk in saying, I'm an accountant and I'm a bookkeeper, you're both giving yourself a limited label of what your role is. And you're also giving the client a limited label of what your role is. So both of you are setting a mutual expectation that you have a narrow task at hand. But when you call yourself an advisor and you walk in saying, my job is to be your business advisor, your trusted advisor, whatever term you want to use. When you say that, language is powerful. And when the client says, why are you asking why? It says, in order for me to provide advice, I need to understand. And what you're telling me explains a part of it, but I don't understand why. And it's okay to ask why. Why is the only question, I believe, in my opinion, that is not questioned as a stupid question. Like every question in the world could be somehow labeled as a stupid question. Why can't? Because there's no way to take why and label it stupid. This is why little kids, you know, my little kids, they don't ask long, complicated questions. They ask why, because why is, philosophically speaking, the most open to interpretation question. And the nice thing about why is that you're not pushing the client towards any specific answer. You know, there are, you know, in court, in the law, there are things called leading questions. I call it rhetorical questions, which are questions meant to give you a specific answer. Like if you ask someone, would you like to take more vacations? That is a leading question. Like almost everybody will tell you yes. And that's actually a great question to ask. No, so that's, even though it's a leading question, it's a good question to ask. Why? Because accountants don't ask that question. And I got to tell you, accountants don't take enough vacations. I don't take enough vacations. So when a client tells me I don't take enough vacations, I say, I feel you, brother. I feel you. And you know what? We're both going to work hard to take a vacation. And when you're charging the client a couple thousand dollars a month and you're helping them take a vacation, and then they say, you're going to take a vacation with this money I'm paying you. You say, absolutely. And basically you create this really interesting bond, because I believe that accountants and bookkeepers that run their own practices, we are business owners and we both have the same pain points. And we both want to disconnect. So, yeah. So I would say absolutely the why is the other one. The other thing that you want to do is, again, instead of trying to find answers in the numbers, find answers in the words. And I'm telling you, more often than not, the numbers is what help us justify what we say. That's where an accountant is. We use the numbers as a backup to what we're saying, or we use the numbers that we want to get to as a backup to what we're asking. But the numbers never give you the answer. It's possible that they paint an overall picture. They do kind of paint an overall picture of the story of the business, but it is those questions. It is the words that are the most powerful. So one of the key questions I ask, other than, you know, would you like to take more vacations? And I think this is one of those big, huge questions that the client needs to roll back in their chair. And they need to say, give me a second, let me think about it. Which is, if you would shut your business down, sell it to anyone, and you were to start over in another country, in another state, and you were going to do the exact same thing, what would your business model look like? And that's the question that gets people thinking. And if the client looks at you, you know, kind of like squint the eye saying, huh, you are building a bond. And that's probably one of the strongest bonds you can build if their previous accountant didn't ask that. Now, if the previous accountant asked that, they're like, oh, awesome question, my last accountant. And by the way, if the last question asked that, if the last accountant asked that, I would really wonder why they lost that relationship with that accountant, because it is likely that client is a pain in the butt and the other accountant kicked them out. But if you are getting, you're asking them awesome questions and they're not used to it, that's the value hook. That's how you become an advisor, and that's how they see you as an advisor. But I think you almost must always start by saying, hey, my job is to give you the best possible business advice, but I need to understand why you do what you do and how your business functions.
I like the idea of get away from the numbers. You even said this to me, you know, before we started recording, something about tax season. I think the phrase tax season traps accountants and bookkeepers. And I completely agree that they have to get away from the numbers. The words the client uses, the adjectives a client uses may be the most important thing, because adjectives describe how we feel about something. And if you're going to be a consultant or an advisor instead of an accountant or a bookkeeper, you've got to get to that emotional component. We decide to buy emotionally, and then we justify it logically. And so that's what I'm trying to get to in that first conversation, not necessarily emotionally why they would buy from me, although that's part of it, but I'm really just trying to understand emotionally what's driving them to pursue this opportunity or to solve this particular problem. The idea of getting away from numbers is great. I brought up tax season, and accountants are defined by tax season, at least the most common accountants that I know. Typical accountant, I think, would be the way to say it. The most innovative accountants are not defined by tax season. Now, I know two types of accountants that are not defined by tax season. There are accountants who do not do tax returns. It's easy for them not to be defined by tax season because they refer the tax work out. But there's also accountants who do tax returns, but they're not defined by tax season either. And the reason is the taxes are not a significant part of what they do for the customer. At least the customer does not perceive the most valuable thing being doing the tax return. And that's really how you get out of the tax season mentality. You know, you mentioned vacations. By the way, great question about vacations. I might, you know, suggest another way to ask it would be, when's the last time you took a vacation? Where'd you go and how long was it? Now, you may not ask all three of those things. You might start off with just, you know, when was your last vacation? But I'd also like to know where they went and how long they went. And by the way, I want to know if it was tied to a conference or, you know, a better question. I'm thinking on my feet here, but when's the last time you took a vacation that had no connection to business at all? Wow, that's a powerful question. I mean, I'm asking myself that question, and I'm not going to reveal the answer here because I'm ashamed of the answer. But anyway, you know, it's that kind of a question that I think we're after. So yeah, this idea of getting out of tax season, and you think about you as an accountant or bookkeeper, you know, when's the last time you took a vacation? All right, now your reaction to that question.
Can I rephrase that?
Put yourself on the other side of it.
Kirk, can I rephrase that for a question? You said, just make sure I got that. You said, when's the last time you took a vacation that was not related to work? Is that what the question is?
Yeah.
So I would say also, you know, I would say, again, your personality matters and how you want to ask it would matter. But I would say another way of asking that is, what's the last time you took a vacation in which you didn't take your laptop, you didn't pay for the Wi-Fi, and you didn't check your email at least once, right? I mean, that's pretty much what you're saying, correct?
Yeah. And so what you're doing is you're being more specific. I love that. I love how you're pushing me on, you know, not work related. You're defining what work related is. Now, one thing I find, if you know, like right there, when you said didn't take your laptop, didn't connect to Wi-Fi, and didn't check email, I would pick one of those three, right? So, and I was, just as I'm thinking through it, so which of those three would I ask? Well, didn't take your laptop. That's a pretty big deal, right? But you still have a mobile device. So I'm thinking didn't check work email, you know, something just really targeted. And you figure out what it is for you. But I love that idea where you're giving a specific activity. You're defining what does a vacation with work versus vacation without work mean? And that the more specific you are, it's going to challenge the customer.
It would either be that you didn't check the work email or call the office, because you also want to, if you're an advisor to a specific industry, you also want to sound like you understand the industry. So if you're talking to maybe a transportation company, which the owner is the dispatcher, very typical, by the way, and basically they're talking to truck drivers all day long on the phone, they're not emailing them. So they're going to tell you, yeah, I took a vacation last week and I didn't check email at all. And that may send you the wrong answer because I didn't actually ask what you wanted. So it's that piece of the questions, what you're saying, the why, where you also want to discover what's the management style of that business owner and how much they are involved. You know, one of the questions I like to ask is, you know, how many emails do you get a day, or how many emails you respond to a day, or how many phone calls from your office do you get a day, or how often do you get to step out of your office in a week to visit clients and develop business? All three of those questions will give you an idea for what the business has done to that business owner in terms of restricting what they want to do, how they want to work, or forcing them to be in one place or be available in a very specific way. And as a software programmer or a database programmer, you possibly can offer a little bit more options in terms of automating things with technology. But as an accountant that knows that 90% of the events in the business get recorded in the accounting system, we know that all those events touch some non-accounting event, you know, a sale, a delivery, a purchase, an estimate, a discount to a customer, a refund to a customer, if you had an irate customer, whatever, a raise to an employee, hiring a new employee. Almost every non-accounting event, it's somehow triggered at the end to an accounting event. So as an accounting professional, we can use those numbers, those transactions, for us to know what are all the trigger points in which our involvement can change the non-accounting aspects of the business to that business owner. But we need to understand, you know, what is that business owner currently confined to and limited to in terms of how they function to work and how they function to have a role in that business.
So I want to ask you a question, just kind of taking advantage of your accounting expertise. Do you find there are certain transactions that are most significant in most businesses, or do the most significant transactions or type of transactions vary across businesses? And so where I'm going with this is, it occurs to me that one of the things accountants and bookkeepers are very well equipped to inquire about are types of transactions. And you want to inquire about the most significant transactions, but then I don't want to assume that the most significant transaction is the same. And secondly, software developers could learn from this knowledge. So what do you have to say? Most significant transactions in businesses, are they the same across the board, or do they vary, and how do you find it?
No, they absolutely vary. One, you know, obviously large sales, abnormal sales are important. Like if you're noticing that this business has, you know, an average of 30,000 to 40,000 in revenue every month, but all of a sudden August they had 90,000. You can ask something like, what happened in August? And they can tell you, oh, August, that's when XYZ customer came in. And you can say, well, how did it go with that new customer? Oh, it was great, or it was bad, or we charged too much, or we charged too little. And you can say, you know, are these events going to happen again, or do you foresee for them to happen again? And they can say, not sure. And we say, if you like that customer or that event, you know, could you retrace your steps and find out what you did differently in terms of your marketing, how you answer the phone, how you approach the client to actually get that extra piece of business? So we can try to figure out what day-to-day accounting behaviors or behaviors that are somehow triggered or, you know, to an accounting related report, we can build in place in order to assure that big increase in sale, however it happened, it can happen again. Same thing if there's a big dip in sales. You know, like we had summer. Summer's always slow. And we say, well, what are you doing differently in summer to prepare for the good months? Or you know, what can we, you know, is it worth it to think about developing a product or a service that is the alternative, to what you do in order not to get that shock in seasonality? Because everyone gets stressed during the bad season, right? I mean, because, you know, there's less cash flow. The expenses are about the same. You can also look at expenses. One of the things I love to do with my clients is look at a profit and loss for the whole year, a rolling 12-month profit and loss that shows all the expenses by category in by month. And what I like to do is this is more technical work with accounting and chart of accounts. I build a chart of accounts that can create real high level summaries. You know, we split expenses into three, payroll or labor, operations, and sales and marketing. So we create three big buckets, payroll, operations, and sales and marketing. And then within that, we create all the subcategories, all the details. So that what allows me to do is allows me to take a real high level eagle's eye view of the expenditures month to month or quarter to quarter. And instead of looking at one specific one, like, oh, our computer expenses went up. Oh, because we repaired the computer. You know, that's not an important event. But if we have something like labor went up 2 months out of the year, and then they tell you, yes, these are the most intense, this is high season, this is what we think about. Hey, you know, are you paying overtime? Do you have people prepared that you can, you know, can you outsource some of the labor, maybe not burn your employees out? Or maybe the other way, you know, let's not outsource it. Let's reward your employees with overtime, you know, that sort of thing. So it's just the individual transactions sometimes tell the story, but it's really the patterns, you know, it's the correlation between one action and the results. And the accounting only gives you the results. You have to build the actions around it, actions before or actions after. Results can also give you an aftermath, you know, like a big increase in payroll can give you an aftermath, like cash flow problems, and it can cause stress afterwards. Or, you know, taking a big job that is too big for you to handle or doing something that's not your specialty could also somehow give you an increase in payroll. Why? Because your people are basically learning on the job. So it's the combination of the numbers and the actions outside of it and trying to figure out those correlations. That to me is the best way you can serve your client as an advisor.
One of the things I want to point out from your last statement is you're not making an assumption that a big sale is good or bad, right? Everybody assumes, oh, you got a big sale, it must be awesome. Well, not necessarily. If you're in a service business and you just landed what we call a gorilla or a whale client who's going to take up more than 50% of your resources, that's a bad thing. That's a very bad thing, because guess what? As quickly as you gained them and it took your business to another level, one thing, one misspoken word, one bad social media photo or quote or whatever can take that away from you. And so big sales, not necessarily good or bad. And so not only looking for what are, I'd say you're looking for three things, right? You're looking for the peaks, you're looking for the valleys, but then you're also looking for the curve or the trend over time. Not only to see, are there certain busy months of the year, certain down months of the year, but what's a typical expenditure in those categories so you'll be able to recognize a peak or a valley, correct? Very, very, I think, astute observation on your point. And just the simple idea, and I understand, yes, you have to have the right chart of accounts. You know, you started by saying, okay, we're going to have three top level, and then we're going to have subcategories so you can look at it. But I'm curious, I'm just always blown away. I've always said this. I feel like accountants and bookkeepers, because they have access to the customer's numbers, are in one of the best positions to be a true advisor or consultant, because you can do things like run chart of accounts by month. So what if they're not the right accounts? Well, you might be able to figure that out, right? Just by looking at it. I mean, would you agree that just by running a chart of accounts by month, can give an accountant or a bookkeeper insight if they know what they're looking for?
Yeah, it absolutely can. Or at least it prepares them for the questions. Like, I don't think you know, maybe you're not necessarily going to find the answers in the numbers, but you are going to find the areas in which it's worth asking questions around. So it does sort of give you the map, your plan of action on how to approach the advisory. So yeah, I'll wrap this up, Kirk, by telling you something that maybe you don't know. It's more unique to the accounting industry. The reason why accountants don't, let's call it, weaponize the access to the numbers for advisory is because we by trade are supposed to be independent. And this is something that goes, this has to do with public accountants, you know, issuing financial statements to the public and to the stock market, public companies and that sort of thing. But we are supposed to be independent. And when we're independent, we're not supposed to give an opinion about the individual aspects of the numbers. What we're supposed to do is give an overall opinion on whether or not the client is fairly stating their financial state. And that's the true role of a certified public accountant. Now, not all, which is funny, most accounting engagements are not about audits and giving public opinion of numbers. Most of them are to solve problems. So if you're an accountant that needs to be independent and needs to work that way, you're probably out of luck. You probably can't give advisory. But if you know or you're comfortable with not ever being the one that gives public opinion about those numbers, all you have to do is say, hey, that will not be my role. My role is to be your inside accountant, your virtual CFO, your instant, your on-demand CFO, and give you the type of advice that most accountants don't, because they're afraid that they'll lose independency. My goal here is not to be independent. My goal is to be part of the business with you. With that being said, we just need to know and understand that when your bank asks me to sign your financial statements, I can't. So that's kind of like, that's the reason why we usually don't weaponize it as much for advisory. It's because we're sort of mired in the concept of independence.
Okay, I want to probe on that. Okay, because what I'm hearing you say is this idea of independence is kind of like, you know, the doctor's creed, do no harm. Okay, the accountant's creed sounds like might be, you know, don't be biased or remain independent. But yet, as an outsider, I'm sitting here thinking, I don't want my accountant to be independent. I want my accountant in my business. I want somebody. So are you saying, number one, that accountants are trained in this way, so it just makes it harder for them to go there? Or are you saying that there's an ethical obligation that prevents them from going there? Expound on that. I'm really curious.
Yeah. So CPAs in particular, so this is only limited to CPAs, they have high ethical standards, and they could potentially give a public opinion about the fairness of numbers. If you tell someone that I think these numbers are fair and they're overstating their income, someone may invest in that business or lend them money to their detriment, right? Or to say that those assets are accurate. So the challenge is that the reason why the CPA profession exists as a regulated profession is so we can have the capacity to give public opinion or to say this is fair, okay, these numbers are fairly stated. What I'm saying is that most small businesses don't need that, or they can get a lot more from you if they use you for 90% of what they need and they use a separate accounting firm for that. The thing is that accountants are so afraid of potentially losing the revenue of a review engagement or a compilation or an audit engagement that they stay independent from the get-go. That way they could potentially say yes to that type of work. So it's just, you kind of have to, so accountants have to choose. You know, you're either going to be an independent person stating your opinion about the fairness of somebody, of a third party's numbers, because you're not interlocked with that client in any way. It's completely a cold relationship, right? I mean, accountants can't even receive a gift from their clients. They can't even, so if I'm auditing your books, I can't give you a Christmas gift. I can't receive a Christmas gift. It's against the ethical standards. But if you say, yes, I am a CPA, I am an accountant, but my role would be not to be independent, then that pretty much opens up the whole thing. But you have to make sure that you cannot sign anything out of there in which you give an opinion and somehow tell people that you're independent, because you're not. So that's really the challenge. And this is coming from years and years and years. And some of us just do it innately. We want to be transparent and independent innately, because that's where our training comes from. But that is, even for myself, making this transition to be more of an advisor, I have to sort of say that up front and set that expectation up front. So it's all about expectations at the end of the day.
So number one, I think I'm just going to use it a little bit broader. People in the financial sector, accountants, bookkeepers, you know, financial advisors, whatever. You do need to have this idea of independence, but I love the fact that you brought it up, that it's a choice, that you're going to have to decide, you know, what type of customer, what type of engagements do you want? Do you want this type of, you know, yeah, I'll, you know, I will sign this as an independent, you know, forgot my word. Anyway, this idea that you want to be independent or do you want to be an advisor? And I could keep going, but I can see we're getting close to 50 minutes here. So let's wrap it up. But I want to continue this idea. I think there's a part two to this that I want to continue next week. I think we've hit something here that I'm just generally curious about. And I actually think a lot of your colleagues may not have thought about it where I want to take it. So
yeah, so I think that's perfect. So next week we'll talk about independence, ethics, and advisory and how all that stuff works together or not work together. How about that?
Sounds good. See you in 168 hours.
All right. See you next week. Thank you, everybody, for joining the Art of Advisory.